Welcome to the Conan Doyle Casebook, where there's always a story to tell. Welcome to the Conan Doyle Casebook, brought to you from the Sir Arthur Conan Doyle Centre here in Edinburgh. And tonight my guest is Canon Francis McCarthy, who's an international medium, best-selling author and public speaker. Now, Canon grew up steeped in the Celtic mysticism and spiritual traditions of Ireland. And as a child, she communicated with spirits. As an adult, her desire to be of service evolved into a passion for social justice and the pursuit of truth, which led her to a career as a major media political journalist and an embedded Iraq war correspondent. A tragic loss became the catalyst that brought her back to spirituality, particularly Eastern philosophy, and working with the mediumistic faculty she's had since childhood. Good evening, Karen.
Good evening, Ewan. It's Hello. Nice to be here.
And you do actually stay in New York now.
Yeah, I spent quite a lot of time in New York. I'm in Dublin a few months of the year, but of late I've been in New York most of the year.
So I think it's slightly earlier in New York at the moment. It's about 4 hours behind, or...?
Yeah, they're 4 hours behind, but I'm in Dublin at the moment.
Oh, you're in Dublin late. At the moment.
Yeah. It's later, yeah.
Okay, so welcome back to Ireland. So on that note, tell me a little bit about growing up in Ireland and the spiritual traditions which you grew up in.
Yeah, I grew up in Ireland, you know, when it was still a fairly Catholic country. Well, a very largely Catholic country I grew up in. And so, you know, went to the normal stuff. But, you know... There's always the sort of knowledge of the folklore that's just sort of there in the sort of conversation, just runs into conversation. And I was giving a talk on this for Halloween, actually, the other night on Samhain and on the thin places in Ireland, you know, the cairns and the dolmens and the whatnot. And these were just things that were just understood, you know, weren't really questioned, weren't really discussed. But so the fairy mounds, for example, they're all over the place, but there was a fairy mound in an industrial estate up the road from our house. It was a Cadbury's chocolate factory. And they built the whole industrial estate around the fairy mound because these things weren't to be disturbed, do you know? And it's kind of a nice tradition that it hasn't been overrun. I mean, there was a motorway being built and it actually was going to go right through a fairy mound and it was routed to go round it, you know? So fairy mounds are the mounds where the fairies, but the fairies are the diminutized version of the ancient gods of Ireland, the Tuatha Dé Danann, that became miniaturized with the coming of Christianity to be able to reckon, as this happens in most folklore mythologies, you know, trying to reconcile the pagan gods with the Christian gods. So the Shi, which were the pagan ancient gods, were diminutized to become fairies, which have gotten all over the world by now, you know. But that was just there. I mean, the Banshee was just, you just understood that when you heard screaming and crying out in the street, it was the Banshee, and you knew not to look at her, she'd throw her comb at you and kill you, you know. So there's all these stories. You just grow up with them as a kid. You don't even think twice about them. You don't even really question them, you know.
I also think that's where Ireland, it kind of shares a history, I always think, with Scotland as
absolutely.
Well, around that and growing up and traditions that go way back. But here you are growing up with these traditions, but you started seeing spirit yourself at such a young age.
I did. And, you know, it was one of those things, and I know quite a lot, this happens to quite a lot of kids. My friend has a child who this happens to as well, where you'd just sort of wake up in the middle of the night and you just see somebody standing sort of at the end of the bed, just looking at you, not doing anything, you know. And I would just look at them and be like, but I don't even know who you are, you know. And you just go back, I just go back asleep. They'd just go away. And this would happen a lot. And I had some really... really kind of scary incidences when I was, I mean, a lot of the time they're scary because we don't know what's happening, right? It's just a lack of understanding. But which I actually wrote about in my book, which Till Death Don't Us Part, which you and I have talked about before, you know, just things moving and, just all of this sort of stuff going on, figures seeing. But it's I think it's quite common for a lot of kids to see that, and I think what's wonderful is when parents aren't afraid of it, or parents don't try to think, oh, my kid needs medication because they're hallucinating or whatnot. When parents are able to actually just be open to the idea that this is possible is wonderful, I think, just for the kids. So I did see that, but when I was a child, but you kind of then become a teenager, and then you don't want to know. Do you know what I mean? Because you just want to go to discos or clubs, or you just want to make boys, and do you know what I mean? Fashion. And so by the time I got into my teens, 14, 15, I just stopped seeing them. I think I just wasn't open to it, wasn't interested in it anymore. And they just stopped appearing for the. I mean, when I look back now, there are certain events that happened in those years that I understand now were significantly sort of psychic in their nature, which I didn't really think about at the time. But yeah, by the time I got to 14, I'd really lost interest in it, and it just all stopped happening. And as I got older, got into college, and I had less and less interest in anything spiritual. So, you just kind of grow in this. Oh,
So
I did anyway.
it sounds very much like seeing spirit and sensing spirit very much became a normal part of life throughout childhood. And also sounds like family were quite supportive of this as well.
Yeah, I didn't actually really tell my parents about. I mean, I have to be honest, I was never scared by these people who came along. Do you know what I mean? I did have a sense of my grandmother at one point. I did. My mother would remember it. She told me later, like I would be having a conversation out through the door into the hallway, sort of thing. And she'd say, "Who are you talking to?" And I'd be like, "Oh, that man." And she'd look out, and there wouldn't be a man there. But so she just thought it was imaginary friend, and that was the end of that. And it just ticked along like that, So I know now it wasn't imaginary friends, because if it was an imaginary friend, it probably would have been a purple elephant or something, just a strange man in the hallway, So yeah, it wasn't really. I mean, I think a lot of Ireland, I'm sure it's similar in Scotland, these things are sort of known and sort of understood, and nobody makes an issue out of that. Nobody particularly talks about it a lot, but neither do anybody really make an issue out of it,
I often find that when you start later on looking back in family, you find that there's these connections there going back through history. And I was just wondering if it was similar with yourself and looking back into family.
Well, I know that my father told me my great grandmother would see things or see people. And I know that even though my mother would sort of write these off as imaginary friends, I know she had these experiences herself, and she didn't really indulge them very much. Do you know what I mean? I think it's a lot more common than people realize. And I think that too many people have a tendency just to decide it was a hallucination or imaginary friend, or they know it wasn't, but they don't want to tell anybody. But I think I think this is far more common than we realize.
So into your teens, you were saying it kind of left, or you weren't really interested in it at that point because everything else, of course, was going on. And then as the years go on, it takes you into a completely new world, into politics and the field of journalism.
Yeah, I went out to Hollywood first and ran around Hollywood for a while and had a bunch of interesting experiences out there and traveled around the traveling circus for a while. And I had that sort of like life in your 20s when you're just sort of out to live as big as you can for as long as you can, I eventually did. I had when I was younger, I was always interested in writing. And when I was younger, 17, 16, 17, I would write for the local sort of newspaper and did this. I eventually kind of came back around to journalism after running amok around Hollywood for a while, and decided I started covering US politics for the Irish Examiner, and then ended up in Iraq covering some stories in Iraq for the Irish Times during the war in like 2006. And it just kind of suited me at the time to be sort of folk. I was more interested in what is going on in the world than I far more, and I had really practically zero interest in even existential questioning, to be honest, at that point, you know. But Iraq was, people often asked me, did you come back to it because of Iraq? And it really wasn't. I mean, the thing about Iraq is those experiences, they brought some people back to spirituality. But for me, it was just horrible to see the things that human beings are capable of doing to each other, you know. So I didn't really find that at all to be spiritual. It wasn't really until many years later, as you know, that when my fiancé died, that, you know, it's kind of like dropped, kicked back into it, you know. I was just, you know, you go to college, you're living that life, you're just sort of more interested. I was just more interested in the world, you know, than this world, than contemplating another one, you know.
You led on there to, you know, meeting your husband and the tragedy that happened. And you speak about that openly in your book. And I was just wondering if you could just give us a few details about what happened.
Well, we had known each other for some time, you know, in New York. And he was an avid cyclist. And one day he was a skeptic. We're both atheists. Both atheists and skeptics, and which even didn't even label it at the time. Do you know what I mean? Because that's just you are how you are, you know. And but he went out for a bike ride one afternoon and had a sudden massive heart attack. And I was actually in Virginia working on a story, and got a phone call to say that he had had a sudden massive heart attack at 41 and was dead, you know. And you know, I mean, that was just so sudden. It took me days to even comprehend it. You know, I was like, no, it can't be. And like you said, I did talk about that. But she said, how is that possible? We'd only gotten engaged 7 weeks before that, you know, and after a long time of trying to get ourselves together. And then, you know, it's just one day, it was just like that phone call and he's gone, you know. And I know a lot of people have these sudden shocking revelations, but I think when somebody passes, it's got its own sort of elements of shock and creative and, you know, shock and adapt, you know, having to adapt in the grieving process. Because sometimes when you know somebody's about to pass, there is a whole set of grief with that. And there's a whole set of grief with, you know, with the sudden passing. So it's not any greater or lesser trauma than anybody else, but certainly took me quite a few days just wandering about this big old house in Virginia, just trying to absorb what I had just been told, you know.
And yet throughout this, you know, I often say, you know, the journey of, I suppose, grief is a very personal process. And,
yeah.
And different to each and every one of us, where there's mm-hmm. no right or wrong. But you had quite an incredible journey, because you mentioned that skepticism that you had, but that changed.
Yes. And it took an awful lot of work on the part of those in the unseen world, and him included, and quite a lot of time and quite a lot of helpful people on the path to kind of coming around from that. Because, you know, it was such, Ewan, like such a hard turn to get from where I was into believing that consciousness survives death, you know. And it took a long time. It took a lot of people that were sort of, when you look back now, you can kind of see this pattern of helpful people showing up in the most unexpected places. A Catholic priest was one of the first people who helped me. Told, you know, but what started happening was within a couple of days, 2 or 3 days of his passing, all sorts of these things started happening. You know, the bed would shake, some things would tug on my hair, I would smell him, I would, you know, I'd see these black shapes again. And I mean, just endless, very physical forms of manifestation were happening, you know. And it was, I thought, you know, I must be having a nervous breakdown. I must be losing my mind. Like, it took me quite a long time to come to accept that this was something different, and quite a lot of conversations. I was in Virginia at the time, which is kind of like the Area 51 of the afterlife. That's what I called it in my book. The Edgar Cayce Center was there. the Monroe Institute, the work of Robert Monroe. He does, you know, the out of body experiences research. There was a spiritualist, I'd never even heard of spiritualism, but there was a spiritualist church right there. There was all of this stuff happening in this small little area in Virginia. And I actually started by bumping into a Catholic priest, basically, and wanting to ask him, thinking, I need a bit of help. I'm losing my mind here from grief. And I burst into tears and bawled crying to this poor priest. And he was the first one to say to me, no, these are signs. This is quite common. This has happened to lots of our parishioners, which I'd never heard of. But I went and I did a bit of research on that. And I spoke to the lovely Professor Lou Legrand, who had written a beautiful book about this. And we had a couple of phone calls about that. And just more and more and more incidences were happening. And they were becoming more complex and more, just sort of more synchronistic and more elaborate. And eventually, I don't want to give away exactly what happened because it's sort of it's a turning point in the first part of the book. So I don't want to give it away. If anyone wants to read the book, but it became eventually, after a few months of this constantly happening, and then me saying very informed and helpful people along the way, that it became eventually the penny dropped. Eventually, I had that epiphany, just that sort of moment of awakening of the holy. You know, this really is you. But it was a very, very difficult shift for me to make at that point. Because, you know, I was so much older than I was as a kid. I really couldn't remember half of that. It was only later my mother kind of reminded me some of the things and the people I'd encountered in the living room as a child. But it was a very difficult. I was not an easy convert, I have to say. And it took an awful lot of work, an awful lot of help, and an awful lot of energy on the part of those in the unseen world.
Did you constantly wonder how all these coincidences were happening, you know, almost on a daily basis? Where was this from? What was happening?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, initially, like I said, I was just thinking, well, that was odd, or that's just a coincidence. You know, I wasn't seeing them as synchronicities I wasn't seeing intelligence behind these. I thought this is just literally a coincidence, you know. Anything that else, you know, things touching me, tugging on my hair, I thought, I'm imagining it. There was some very, very vivid experiences I had that I just said, that must have had to be a dream, you know. And I wrote everything off for some time. I was trying to excuse it away. Because to be honest, Ewan, first, I actually thought I was having a breakdown because it wasn't natural or normal for me to be imagining stuff like this. So I thought I must have gone out of my mind with grief, but that I don't even understand. I'm a fairly strong-minded individual. I don't even understand how that could have happened. And but that's where I was initially. Then I started, when people started pointing things out, and the Lou Legrand and the priest and people at the Edgar Cayce Center started pointing out things, then I started noticing patterns. And then I started giving just the tiniest bit of credence to some of the things they were suggesting. It was kind of more like a, what if what they said was true? What would that mean here? So for a while, I was in the sort of then the what if. Let me just entertain just for the tiniest moment that some of the things they're telling me are true and that these are intelligent, organized sequences of events. What would that mean? And I was a long time on that, just trying to understand what's moving the furniture, you know. And eventually, that didn't for me even equate with survival of consciousness. Do you know, that was just something's moving furniture. There's some kind of energy. It could be kinetic. It didn't necessarily follow for me that this was discarnate consciousness. You know, and so that was a whole other step. It's quite a long and difficult road that I went down, but the events kept happening. You know, if they had stopped, I probably would have given up, but they kept happening. And so there really was nothing else to do but to continue to try to investigate, to find an explanation for these things. And ultimately, that explanation led from A to B to C to the recognition that intelligence survives. Consciousness survives, but intelligence, there's intelligence behind it, you know.
Wasn't an absolute significant moment of something that happened that just said, yes.
Well, this is
the evidence here, or was it accumulation?
Well, there was definitely an accumulation, but there was one point in time that was the holy moment, you know, where which the whole first 100 pages of the book leads up to, which, so I don't really want to give it away in case anyone wants to read the book. But there definitely was that penny dropping moment where it would have finally realized, oh my God, this really is you, you know. So if it's all right, I'll leave it for anybody who wants to read the book. So don't want to spoil it on them, because it is a really good sort of twist in the first half of the book, you know.
I think it was extremely interesting. You were talking about you and your husband both being atheists and both being skeptics, yet here you are in your childhood having this, which you seem to know is something from another realm somewhere else, to then enter into these years of skepticism and then to come back to it and perhaps being reminded of, do you remember as a child what you saw and what you saw in the living room and on the stair, etc.?
Yeah, you know, it's funny the things that we're able to sort of, well, I should speak for myself. I just noticed, you know, as I got older, I mean, there were certainly weird things in my youth, in my childhood. And, you know, there's a whole scene in the book where we went on Girl Guides camping week, you know, when I was about 13, and the bunk bed moved and shook and rattled. Big, huge military army bunk bed that 12 kids couldn't have moved, you know, and the thing just started spontaneously shaking and shimmied out into the room. And it frightened the Jesus out of us at the time, do you know, but then afterwards, you kind of sort of can rationalize the stuff. If you really want to rationalize something away, you really will. You know, and that became, it was like some of the instances that happened after my partner died was, if you want to rationalize them away as an earthquake moving the bed, even though nothing else moved, you can convince yourself of these things if you try hard enough, you know, and if you put enough blinkers on, it is possible to ignore stuff. I mean, people walking around the world doing it all the time, right? I think it becomes, how open are you to really honestly looking at all of the various different possibilities that this could be, or are you only trying to convince yourself that this is not possible? And I think unfortunately, a lot of people you see wandering around the world are robbing themselves of extraordinary experiences because they just really want to be able to rationalize something away. And I was one of those people. And I just know that I wouldn't give up these experiences now in the world for anything in the world, because they're so enriching in life, just to understand the presence and the magnitude and the majesty of life. I mean, it makes life so much bigger than just the 7 billion of us running around the planet.
And that remarkable journey that you've had, of course, has taken you on to doing a PhD, which covers such things as NDEs, near-death experiences.
So I'm researching, you know, just, I've noticed this really interesting trend in 21st, very contemporary ghost literature, where very sophisticated, like Booker Man Prize winners and Peabody winners, have started rewriting the ghost story, not as a story like Scrooge or not as a haunting or anything like this, but are relocating, creating these entire worlds and alternative in the afterlife dimensions, like Lincoln and the Bardo, or, you know, Hotel World. I mean, these really highly respected and prize-winning authors, and very sophisticated plots, very sophisticated characters, all of which are dead, so to speak. And there's no such thing as coming back. There's all of these old themes we've all known. Come back to haunt, come back to avenge a murder. All the Lovely Bones is another one. All of these old traditional themes have gone out the window. And something very new and very sophisticated is being explored now in the literature. And so I started researching, why is that? And so I started looking into how have we shifted our thinking and our understanding of consciousness, our place in the world, or the possibility of the afterlife. And so this literature now is exploring things like eco-devastation, like trauma and trauma recovery in the spirit world, you know. And it's really, really interesting stuff to me to see this very sophisticated shift in how life and the continuity of life is being perceived, and the possibilities for what is being entertained now that was never entertained in the thousands, how many, 2,000 years, up to 2,000 years since we had the Iliad, you know, we're seeing very sophisticated interpretations of that. And I started asking, how has this shift happened? And so I'm looking at, you know, we've got the emergence of quantum physics. I know that's been around for 100 years almost now, but we also have now on the back of that sort of consciousness theory, we have the medical advancements that have given us so many NDEs to be able to study, which people weren't able to be resuscitated the way they are today. And that's really, there's the sort of impact of counterculture and Eastern influences and just this sort of mind-opening way of starting to look at the world a bit differently. And so for me, it's kind of like this has all come together in one big melting pot. And it's like the dialectic. There's the original idea, there's the argument, and now there's the third point, the third state is arising out of all of this, which I think is fascinating, you know, for us who are interested in the afterlife.
It does seem that science has kind of come a long way into looking at ideas such as, for instance, there was the belief that the brain is consciousness, the brain is the consciousness, to where the brain and consciousness can be two separate things.
Yeah, the brain is the end, yes. Yeah.
And it seems to be, in a way, great that science is starting just to dabble a bit into this.
Yeah. Yeah, it's absolutely. I mean, you know, David Chalmers is doing some interesting work on consciousness and, you know, and there's, well, you know, Dean Radin, you've had quite a lot of them, give the Tuesday talks. Rupert Sheldrake is just wonderful work. And Penrose. I mean, there's just this long list of great scientists exploring these. I mean, I do think we need to be careful that we don't make scientism a religion. You know, where if science says it's true, then it's true. And if science doesn't say it's true, it's not true. I think all of this stuff is not measurable, which it needs to be scientifically proven. And so, but I think it's really interesting that people are opening up these avenues. I mean, a lot of these great scientists like Niels Bohr or Erwin Schrödinger, when they were working with these early days in quantum physics, admit that they went to Vedanta, that they went to the Upanishads for inspiration. They were going to Eastern spiritual traditions to be able to understand science. So I think, to be honest, I know the scientists would hate me for saying this, but I think that spirituality can inform science, to be honest, more than science can inform spirituality, if that makes sense. Because spirituality, when they start looking at these concepts, allows them to start thinking in different ways. Well, this is what we know from Schrödinger and Bohr and quite a few other people. I mean, David Bohm worked with Krishnamurti, you know. So I think that it's great that this research is being done, and I think it's great that these are being seriously entertained as possibilities. And because we have to be able to ask the why. And I think what's important with scientism sometimes, and I know Evan Alexander says this a lot, too many scientists are there to disprove the theory, you know, and he says this about the near-death experiences. Science is, by and large, sort of sets out to debunk and to explain away the near-death experience rather than to look at how is it possible. But fortunately, we do have a handful of very open-minded scientists who are asking these very philosophical and existential questions, which I think can only further the discussion, because the minute you start trying to limit anything, discussion ends. So I love the fact that, you know, people like Penrose and Sheldrake and, you know, Radin and the others are actually really starting to explore what could be, what could this be?
Yeah, exactly. And I was going to ask, this may put you on the spot a wee bit, but where do you see maybe in 50, 100 years' time, science and spirituality?
Well, I think we need to stop seeing science, treating science like it's a religion. I mean, scientism is almost like a religion. People, it's not a theistic religion, obviously, but it's like people believe that science is the be-all and end-all, which we know it's not, because science is always disproving itself. 50 years, what we believe today, I mean, all you have to do is look at relativity to quantum. There's always advances in science. It would be fantastic if in 100 years there was an actual understanding of the nature of consciousness. You know, I know David Chalmers is trying to put forth consciousness as a fundamental property of the universe, like light and electromagnetism and, you know, strong weak forces. It would be great if that we had made that breakthrough to start really starting to look at consciousness in an entirely different way, so that it is something that is a fundamental property of the universe, that the brain is more like an antenna tuning into, you know, and to understand that these things are actually separate. That would be, to me, huge that way forward for science.
Now, we're almost at the end of our time tonight. The time on the podcast always goes so quickly. But your book, A Fascinating Read, Till Death Don't Us Part, A True Story of Awakening to Love After Life. It's available through Amazon, I believe.
Yeah, all major booksellers. It was published by White Crow Books in England, actually. And all major books. And there's an audio book now as well that came out this year too. So me narrating. So.
Excellent. And of course, you have a website as well.
Yeah, KarenFrancesMedium.com. Francis with an E, girls, Francis. KarenFrancesMedium.com.
So to find out more details about what you're doing. Well, as I say, it's been fascinating speaking to you. And I hope you'll come back.
I'd love to.
For our second season, which we'll be looking at shortly, and to talk a little bit more.
We'd love to, yeah, definitely.
Well, once again, thank you very much and a very good night.
Good night, Ewan.
Thank you.